friend of mine was reading to me last night, we were on the phone, a statistic of what happens in some people's lives on an average. And I thought it was interesting, and it very much was related to what I was wanting to address today. He said, if you take 100 people and you look at them at age 65, you start with 100 people and then you let them live their lives out. At the age of 65, 23 will have already died. So you're down not to, again, the whole sample. But out of 100 people starting at birth, at the age 65, one will be wealthy. Wealthy mean, you know, enormous amount of resource. One out of 100. Five will be financially independent, which effectively means they can reasonably well do what they want. In a, you know, they couldn't go buy a company, maybe, but they could travel and not have to worry about their financial cares. So that's 6 out of 100. 6 more will be still working at age 65, and 65 out of 100 will be dependent on family members or government programs to survive. Now think about that. Out of 100 people from birth, when they get to the age 65, 65 of them will be dependent on the for their support on family members or government programs, which would include Social Security, which you could say as well, that is our money and they're just returning it to us, and they are. It's just that it's not there anymore, what it was that you turned in when you were working. So it is a matter of faith in the institution of our nation. That's a rather recent dynamic, because many of the social programs that exist in our country did not exist prior to World War II. They didn't have the same social programs before that. In fact, for 6,000 years of man's history, basically, you either provided for yourself or you starved. You know, the famine in Ireland, of which so many immigrated to the United States. And the wars and the trials where people had to flee from one country to another or one land to another, and the losses and the devastation. For 6,000 years of man's history, you either provided for yourself and obviously your family, or you starved. I remember when I did the memorial service for Gertrude Renner, one of the members attending up in Post Falls, and I had sat with her in her home as she had described prior to her dying, but sitting there describing her life in the country and how they survived, and the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of quarts of canning that they would put up every year, because you had to provide for yourself in season. You raised your crop in the summer, you canned it in the fall, and you lived off of that canned food through the winter. If you did not put up your food, there was none to be had. So you went, in that sense, from season to season. We have largely lost the mentality of preparing for the future in that way. There are seasons in life. Proverbs 6 refers to this in a what seems to me at least a very colorful way, but very important. Proverbs 6, verse number 6. It says, go to the ant, you sluggard. Boy, I hope you're not referring to us. Consider her ways and be wise, which having no captain, overseer, ruler, or government provider, no social programs for the ants, right? Provides her supplies in the summer, gathers her food in the harvest. How long will you slumber, O sluggard, and not make provision for your supplies in the summer, gather it in the harvest so that you can eat it in the winter? That's the lesson. That's the point. This is before social welfare became part of the United States economy. Am I saying that nobody should receive government assistance? That is not my point. My point is that historically, we were to at least strive and attempt to make provision for ourselves. When indeed we were not able to do so, then those people God said, the indigent, those who are poor among you, those who are widows that have a reason, they have lost their provider, with little children maybe, raising children, or orphans, they need our care. So God said to care for those who are indigent among you. But in saying that, he also said, let the rest of you labor with your hands to provide. Do not slumber. Make provision for yourself. When will you rise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall your poverty come on you like a robber, and your need like an armed man. It's like we wake up, and all of a sudden, it is all gone. I have had people ask me, well, what is it I need to be learning from this lesson? And there are times when I cannot answer the question. If I was to answer the question, it would cause offense. Now, does that mean I can never say anything if it causes offense? That's not the point. Sometimes the lesson is, would you stop what you are doing and do something the right way? Again, very selectively, just because a person asks for advice does not mean they're interested in receiving it. It has to be wisely dispensed. I wish that on the subject that I'm addressing to you today that I had been wiser myself in this way. I cannot speak to you as having done that all which I should have, but it is still an important subject. And even if my marriage is troubled, I must speak on what it would be that we should do to make it right. Now, I can't be a hypocrite, because I must be striving to implement that which I also teach. I can only say that there are issues in the Bible that must be addressed in some cases that I would like to say, well, you know, if I could only address the ones where I had actually perfectly applied them, then you know what? There would not be a lot of sermons for me to give. So I have to walk into areas that I have to stop and take accounting at times for myself in the process as well. In Micah 4, there is a principle here that is very fundamental. Micah 4 always takes me a little longer in the minor prophets because I got to start with Hosea. I never learned my 12, so I have to do those on my fingers. And the minor prophets, I have to start with Hosea to find where I'm going, but I get there. Micah 4, verse 1. It shall come to pass in the latter days. This is a great blessing, and God describes what it's like, what it should be like when we're blessed. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established on top of the mountains, shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. It goes on and describes the cessation of the wars and the fighting and the man fighting one against the other, and people begin to pursue peace. And verse 4 it says, everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. His vine and his fig tree. Not somebody else's vine, your own. Maybe it's the vine you planted with your own hands. Maybe it's the vine that your parents planted, but they protected the property and then passed it on down to you. But it is yours. And if you remember in the recent sermon I gave comparing the difference between the person who is an owner and the person who is a participant, the owner gives his life for the sheep. The owner defends his property and rebuilds the business and puts it back in order because it is theirs. And so the reference here in part says that a blessing comes, or at least the results of a blessing would be in part, where we have those things and they are ours. They're not on loan or borrowed. They're not rented or passing through, but they are established. And we are invested in them because of our own labor and our own care. We have, in that sense, ownership rather than debt. That's the point, in part, that's being made. My wife and I were able to buy our first home in Lubbock, which is our assignment before having come to Spokane. We bought that home with a 15-year mortgage, and we made payments on it every 2 weeks. Every paycheck, a payment went in to that mortgage. And that made for 13 months in a year, effectively, because there's two extra payments on paychecks that would then go in. We were transferred after only 6 years. The air base in Lubbock had closed, and the housing market was flat. The house did not appreciate any more than the fact that we put in certain improvements, and those improvements themselves added some cash. But there was no increase. We sold the house for what we paid for it and for what we put in it. But we had been making payments against that mortgage every 2 weeks. And because of the financing change, at one point, the mortgage actually dropped down to a 13-year mortgage, and we continued at the same payment that we had previously. And so again, it began to pay that down a little faster. With absolutely no increase in the market, simply by making payments at a higher level, we were able to come up to Spokane and have the 20% cash we needed just precisely by God's blessing in hand to buy a house in a more expensive market. Spokane cost 50% more than the market cost in Texas. Our job didn't change. Our payroll didn't change. But God allowed us in that way to exercise the fruit of our labor. Now, paying those payments into that house on a 13-year mortgage in the end meant that when the VCR broke, we couldn't fix it. It meant that when the neighbor across the street said, "Would you please mow my lawn for me? I am too busy and it doesn't look the way yours does." We've always obsessed on our lawn. And I said, "You know, I'm really not looking for side jobs. I'm a minister. I'm busy. Please, would you mow my lawn?" I said, "Fine. I will do it for free." "No." And so he would give me $20 a week to go and perfectly mow his lawn. For us, that was chump change. That was fun money. We were trying to pay for a house. And the expenses were such that honestly, and we're talking about an entry-level beginner home, our very first, expenses were such that if something broke, it basically had to be set aside. There was no other way to start to get established. God blessed us in that way. Now, housing since that time has become even more expensive. We got a note this year saying that the tax value of our home and the mortgage on our house in Spokane is larger than the entire house cost in Lubbock. So I'm just telling you how the scale changes when you go from one place to another. You've got to notice that the tax value on our home last year went up 28%. 28% last year. I'm rich, right? We're rich. We're rich. We got all this money. Well, not really. My neighbor's house went up the same amount. And so they have the ability to assess now more tax on the same income. I live in the same house. And if we sold and bought the house next door down the street, not only would we not save anything, but the fees we would pay in the process would indebt us further. It isn't riches in that sense. It's economic manipulation. It is ultimately part of a curse. If we double the money in our pockets, and then we double all the prices, are we really any better off? We are not. I want to read a little bit of an article to you that I thought was just striking to me, because the title of it was "What Really Happened in 1995. Now, striking to me, because this has nothing to do with the church. Again, Randy Stiver and my conversation as we came back from camp had to do, isn't it interesting that there are physical things. When major physical events are happening, there's usually some spiritual implication. There's something happening in the spiritual world as well. And it plays out down here, but we don't always see the connection. We just see what happens down here below. The article starts out, 1995 was, by any reasonable accounting, an unremarkable year. Can anyone remember anything significant that happened in 1995? He says, I sure can't. I can. You know what happened in 1995? The church split, crumbled, shattered into pieces, was attacked by Satan, had leaders who went into apostasy and began to teach, or continued to teach, false doctrine. And the church crumbled into pieces at that point. So here's an individual writing about economics, for which I know very little, and which I will try to simplify so I don't have to answer your questions. Although, Rod Hall is with me. He assured me that he had had his master's in international business in management, and that they made him take a course in economics. So if you have a question about what I'm telling you, ask Rod. I got to cover somewhere for my weakness here. But I think it's remarkable. Can anyone remember anything significant that happened in 1995? He says, I sure can't. Life was good. Optimism reigned. But something strange did happen in 95 while all this good living was going on. He goes through and he starts to show that in 1995, the M3, the money supply, a broad measure of money supply in this country, began to expand, in fact, explode almost exponentially. Just a huge, dramatic departure from the historical record of that supply. He said M3 expanded like mad in 1995. There was something going on in the country economically that would lead our nation toward a financial precipice that has happened in 1995 at the same time the church was attacked. What a coincidence. I couldn't believe it when this was pointed out to me. He says, and he has a chart here showing the M3 money supply from like 1969 and then in 1995, and there's this gradual curve and then a kind of leveling off, and then in 1995 it goes on up to last year as the chart flows, and then it just takes on up on a very steep climb at that point. He says there are clearly two eras here, before 1995 and then 1996 and after, and the chart shows a distinct break. He says after 1995, the broad money supply exploded and it has never looked back. Asset bubbles and inflation, mostly one then the other, as a consequence are surprising only those who do not understand basic economic principles of supply, demand, and the way people respond to them. What he's arguing is when you don't have a money supply that is tied to gold or silver or something that actually has specific value, then the ability for the system and the banks then within the system to create money out of the air is a huge risk to that nation and to those peoples. And that's what began to take place. He goes through and explains it in ways that Rod would understand that I am not quite sure of. But he says our banking system is a fractional reserve system, which means that you hold a portion of the funds that are on deposit in reserve as a guarantee. You remember the movie, It's a Wonderful Life? Jimmy Stewart's in there trying to keep the bank solvent, the savings and loan, and he's got this money and he's down to his last dollar, and the person basically says that's okay, you know. He had enough money to cover the money that was out. But the money that a bank has isn't sitting in the bank. The bank loans the money out and keeps a portion in reserve. So what happened back in the early 90s is that the fractional reserve began to be reduced to where the banks were no longer required to keep as much money in reserve. And the intent was to produce liquidity, produce more money, more cash flow, to keep us from sliding into a recession. So you begin to inflate the money supply in that way. And the way they did that, in part, was to reduce the fractional reserve. In fact, that didn't seem to be enough, So they added one more ability, and that was the ability of a bank to then take and move funds from an account that required a reserve to an account that did not require a reserve. An interest-bearing account, which we'd look at as maybe an investment account. So they took further the funds that needed reserves and put them in accounts that did not need reserves, and therefore the reserve requirement was abolished. The argument was that by 1995, the effect was there was a zero reserve requirement in our banking system by the way the funds were able to be manipulated. The banks no longer had to keep money in reserve, effectively. There are certain rules, certain stipulations, but they were able to work their way around it. And what happened? The money supply exploded. You saw it first in the stock market bust, what they call the dot-com bust. You're seeing it now in the housing inflation. The way you give people inflation that is acceptable to them is you pretend that you're putting it into their pockets. So when your house goes up and they send you a bill saying, you know, the value of your house went up 28% last year. I'm rich. No, I'm not. I have nothing. I have exposure now to a tax system without an additional increase in pay. It's called inflation. And inflation erodes, it does not build. So I mention this because, again, you go back to those statistics. Out of 100 people, one's going to be wealthy. Five more are going to be financially independent. There'll be a bunch of them still working, and a whole bunch of the rest of them basically are going to arrive at 65, and they're going to simply be hanging on. God says a blessing is when you sit under your vine and your fig tree. It is a curse if you have to sit under somebody else's. In the church, we need to be responsible in basic and fundamental ways. Look at Haggai. Haggai 1 again. You know, Micah described the blessing. Haggai describes the curse. Haggai 1, verse 1. I think I've got a few more verses on here that I need, but I'll make a note. Verse 3. The word of the Lord came by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses and this temple to lie in ruins? He's coming to encourage the people to do what? To get to work on what God gave them to do. To put God first. To get to work. Now therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much and bring in little. You eat, but you don't have enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. So he describes being part of a system and being participants in it, giving yourself over to it, to where there's no longer a blessing from God. And when you sow, you don't have increase. And when you make money, the expenses overcome the income. And when you take the money that you have left and you put it in a bag, it's as if there were holes in the bag, and it simply dissipates away. Now that would be one way to describe inflation that takes money. A friend of mine said his father retired on a certain amount of income over a certain amount of years, and because the value of the dollar has been reduced year by year by year, when you have a fixed income, you find yourself down the road 5 and 10 years with only half the value of what you started with. The rest has been confiscated because somebody decided to change the requirements on how the finances are produced, on how that nation's responsibilities are being carried out. God says you earn your wages and you put it into a bag with holes. Again, describing the curse. So what do we do? What do we do in an environment when we live in a country that is trying to monetize its debt? You know, they have to monetize Gulf War I, and they got to monetize Afghanistan, and then monetize Gulf War II, which is still going on. Of course, then we have to monetize the fact that all of those weapons that we're sending over there aren't exactly being paid for in cash. In fact, we actually send the weapons to our enemies. We send a couple of $1 billion a year to Egypt, and we know that they're our friends. Last week we had the camp out, and I was mentioning, well, Megan went up on Friday, and I went up on Saturday, and Michelle and Derek came up on Sunday, and I was trying to figure out how to not have three cars up there and personally support the entire terrorist organization in the Middle East. Now, how am I going to do this? We have put ourselves in a position where the very fact that we buy the fuel from the countries who turn around and promote those who would be our enemies and attack us, we are paying for our own destruction. That's where we stand. What do we do in the church in the most fundamental way? Well, Matthew 24 said, who then is a faithful and wise servant? He who not just endures to the end, because endurance is good and it's important, that's what the Bible says, but it's not endurance with your hands clenched and your teeth clenched. It says, he who is still working, he who is laboring, he who is fulfilling my will right up to the end. God said, I want you to labor. I want you to produce. I want you to accomplish. I want you to try to contribute in whichever way you can. Brethren, we need to be workers in the congregation, in our families, in this society to the degree that we are able to contribute and to produce. We need to be profitable, like Onesimus. Profitable. When I was a child in Montana, now you get the story how we walked uphill both ways to school in the snow, right? Okay. Well, when you get old, some of you, you can tell all your stories, and if you're not there yet, then you get to hear ours. That's the way it works. Grade school in Montana, there was a lot of snow in the winter. And you could walk around with a shovel and you could make money. So we left Montana when I was in the fifth grade. But in grade school in Montana, we made money in the winter shoveling snow. And you did it because if you didn't do it, there was no money in your pocket. I've joked before, my parents used to give me a dime to put in the offering in the Presbyterian church. And we would walk ourselves to church right past the store, buy a dime's worth of candy, and eat it on the way. I mean, that was the dime we could get in our hands, so we figured, well, why would we give it to the church? But the fact is, if you wanted a quarter or if you wanted a dollar, you had to go find it yourself. It wasn't being handed to you in the way sometimes it is. In the affluence that we have today. We didn't have that kind of affluence when I was a child. And those who were children before me saw even less then. We live in a society where all of these things have been brought up and put before us and laid at our feet. But it was because somebody sacrificed in advance, because somebody else labored, and because of the promises that God has given to the children of Abraham. Not by anything that we deserve, but out of his own promise and mercy. When I was in the seventh grade, I was able to make enough money doing yard work, most of which was weeding, because nobody else would do it. All kinds of people would mow lawns, but nobody would weed the gardens and the beds, and so I had all the work I wanted. And in the seventh grade, I was able to make enough money in the summer. I think I made $300. Back in the seventh grade, you know, back in, you know, Neanderthal times, that I could buy some of my own clothes. We weren't poor. We had a house. We had a lot of houses. My dad went bankrupt one time. We lost that, the boat. My dad had to start all over. I'm grateful that he started all over. But there still wasn't anybody going to hand you money. It wasn't there. You had to go find it yourself. When I was in the ninth grade, I started washing trucks at a bakery, which was my first real job, which meant I gave up school sports in the ninth grade because I was no longer free to be free after school or on the weekend when the activities would take place. to participate. So frankly, ninth grade was the last time, in fact, the eighth grade was the last time I was participating in school sports because I went to work. When I was 16 years old, I had a bread route and a truck that went up in the mountain, the resort areas above Medford, Oregon, and I could drive out through there in the summer and deliver bread to all the resorts, and I had the time of my life. Remember one time coming down, hit a skunk with the rear wheels, and I backed that truck up and parked it right next to the open windows by the bakery ovens. Man, did I hear about that. But I had a good time, but I was working. God expects us, where we are able, to labor with our hands, which doesn't mean we can't think. It just means to be productive, to contribute, to produce. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse number 9. Concerning brotherly love, you have no need that I should write you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. Now it begins to describe what one form of loving one another then would be. And indeed you do so toward all the brethren who are in Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, that you increase more and more in your love. How can you contribute to someone if you yourself are in need? Is it wrong to be in need? Not necessarily, if you're willing to labor, if you're willing to strive to produce, if you're willing to obey God and not make those kind of decisions that will cause you to go into reverse and then be dependent on society or handouts or social welfare. Now, there are people who arrive there, and they need that. And they arrive there in means that are outside of their control. That is one thing. It is another thing to flaunt God's law and arrive there because society is willing to accept that. That is not what should have been done. That you also aspire to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your own hands as we commanded you. To work, to produce, to be a contributor to society in some way, in whatever way you can. That you may walk properly toward those who are outside and that you may lack nothing. You see, this was before World War II, and the ability of the United States ultimately to put together a social welfare system to where people began to be dependent on the state, to the point where they did not expect to be totally dependent on themselves because they knew they wouldn't starve. And if I'm not going to starve, then I will just trust that I will be cared for and provided for in this way. Everybody cannot work to pay their own way. I understand that. There are those who are handicapped. There are those who are injured. There are those in specific need. I would still give the advice, and I have regularly, to be a contributor and a producer. Go volunteer somewhere. Make some contribution to society. Do not just be a recipient. Be a contributor. That's work. That's labor. Even without pay. Do not just receive. Learn to give. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse number 6. A warning against idleness. We command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which you received from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you. Nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. Paul made tents and provided his own way. Now there were church members who supported him, that he accepted their support, because it was indeed helpful and necessary for his ministry. But there were other places where people, it appears, maybe have resented the fact that they would have had to pay his way. And so among them, he paid on his own. Now, I can assure you that that limited his ability to accomplish in some parts, but God blessed the work of his hands. It says, even when we were with you, we commanded you this, if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. For we hear that there are some who walk among you in a disorderly manner, not working at all, but are busybodies. Now those who are such we command and exhort through our Lord Jesus Christ that they work in quietness and that they eat their own bread. The point being that this life is not about what would be handed to us. It is about what we would strive to save and to produce and to contribute as well. I read that in the Moffat version. It says, if a man will not work, he shall not eat. We're informed that some of your number are loafing, busybodies instead of busy. We charge and exhort such persons to keep quiet, to do their own work, and to earn their own living. That is the effort that we should make. We're heading into times where there are huge economic risks because our country has taken and made decisions that put the entire nation financially at risk. It is dramatic. The charts are pretty clear. We should be producing and laboring and striving to contribute in any way we can. It's not enough to sit there, get in the canoe, head down the river, get swept over the falls and say, oh, I had no hope. No, indeed, you must be paddling. You must be working. God will bless an effort. In fact, what else can He bless but our desire to submit ourselves to Him in that way? Secondarily, I would recommend for us to get out of debt if we are in it and stay out of it if we are not. You know, Megan and Michelle went down to Washington State, is it? I think in Pullman. And they began to look over what the courses will be in another year. And I imagine as they go down, as Megan settles in there in a year from now, and the mailbox is open with her name on it, do you know what she's going to find laying in that mailbox? A whole bunch of credit card offers. I'm going to personally go down there and take all of her mail out of the box every day and tear it up. The system is designed to suck us in. Is designed to merchandise it. Advertising constantly sends us the message that we need to be having fun now. Fun is described as having money and buying things. Now, it's also described as having sex. I'm not talking about sex, so I don't worry about that today. We'll talk about that last week and next week. But today, having money and buying things. You deserve it. How many times do you see an advertisement that says, you deserve it. You have a right to have this much fun or this many things. Coeur d'Alene Casino, winning is just the beginning. Whoa! You mean the base level is winning money, and then after that it gets even better. It's the whole environment that we find ourselves. You know, why wait? Have it now. Just discharge it. Credit card debt is one of the most financially dangerous things there is. It is destructive. It is devastating. It is economic slavery. Credit card debt. Don't do it. Go hungry, go without, but don't do it. Credit card debt. I called up one of my credit cards last night, and I said, how much would this cost me if I started using it as debt as compared to using it to just cash flow? I was shocked. I didn't know. She said, well, the rate on your card is 20.24%. That's the rate if I float money over and pay on that particular card. Or maybe there's other cards, yes, that have a little better rate or something, or they have limits. But the card I've got, if I put money on and leave it, 20%. Can you imagine getting that on an investment? 20%, bang, right out the door. I said, well, what if I miss a payment? What if I goof up or my credit falls? Then what would it be? She says 32%. Right in my pocket. You look in your pocket, and you got the same card maybe, or one like it, or maybe you've got money on one of those, and it rolls over and begins to accumulate. There's no way to climb out of a hole that deep. Almost in, you know, what do you say? 32%. If you're going to buy a car, your first car, that first treasure where you get down the road and buy freedom, you finally get away from the Mickelsons, and you zoom down the road, you know, I'm talking about our own family here, you buy your first car with cash. If you don't have cash, don't buy a first car. Don't buy it on credit. Ride the bus, walk to the store, trade up when you can into what you need. Trade your bicycle with two wheels for four. Don't start out the wrong way. Obviously, I'm talking, in that sense, to younger people. Make purchases with savings, not with debt. You don't buy things for consumption with debt. You don't buy furniture on debt. The washing machine, I don't know, that's tough, because you're going to the laundromat, fine. Go to the laundromat. Don't buy consumption with debt. Don't start a family till you can afford a family. I got married when I was 30. And it wasn't because no girl would have me. It was because there were things that needed to be done first. So I had to wait and just hope that somebody would be left over when I got to be 30 and I could still get married. You know? So, Michelle said she came out of college and she thought it was over right there because she graduated from college and wasn't married and everybody else was. And, you know, here I was out there. And she said, hey, how about we just make a deal here? I think it's probably better than that, right? Don't start a family until you can afford one. You don't do it. You can't. Set aside something from what you make for the future. You'll never make it unless you're a real whiz-bang on a salary in this life. You need not just whatever salary you're going to receive, but you're going to need something that will begin to reproduce itself on your behalf. If you were young and you took a dollar bill and you put it in a bank at 5% interest until 40 years down the road, you'd look at it and it would be $7 bills. It's just a dollar and there was seven. Now, when I was in the service in Vietnam, they said we could put money aside at 10% back then. That was 1971. We could put money in there at 10%. Whatever we had, cash, they'd give us 10%. And back then it was tax-free. If you had a dollar bill that you could invest at 10%, and leave it as long as you left that other one, you would have $45. So the point is this. There are times in the economy when there's 5%, and there's times in the economy when there's 10%. There were a few times when there was 20. But the point is this. If you take a dollar or five, or you take continually a little bit of what you make, and you set it aside, you live below your means, that begins to produce for you. It begins to propel you along, not just so that you can consume it later. It's nice to have the cushion, but so that you will have it when this life is done. I don't mean the grave. I mean your working productive years and the increase that you can work then more faithfully, effectively with your hands. Proverbs 27, verse 23. Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds. Because if you care for those animals, they'll have babies. And the babies will grow up and then they'll have babies. And if you're diligent to make your investment, to make your labor productive and fruitful, be diligent to know the state of your flocks, attend to the herds. Riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure for all generations. When the hay is removed, the tender grass shows itself, the herbs of the mountains are gathered. It's just saying there's cycles that come and go. Give an opportunity by doing your diligence. Due diligence. Megan went down to college yesterday. She says, here's what I want to do. Somebody said, well, I don't think you'll make any money doing that. Why don't you try this instead? So Megan says, well, maybe I need to try doing something that will make some money. That's a good concept. The lambs will provide your clothing. The goat's the price of a field, if you do due diligence, if you look after your herds and your flocks. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food, for the food for your household, the nourishment of your maidservants. So it's important that we be diligent in what it is that we strive to do, but that we produce in such a way not by consuming debt, but by staying out of it in order, in fact, to save. Why? So that we can care for our own and that we can even assist in trying and striving to care for others. God says, do it. Be responsible in those ways. Don't hawk yourself, either for your own desires or for anyone else. Proverbs 22, verse number 26. Do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debt. In other words, if somebody else is responsible to pay it and they can't, then they take it from you. Don't hawk your future for someone else in that way. They must be responsible. If you can give them money, if you can assist them, if you can loan it to them without interest, then do so. But do not take and expose yourself to risk in that way. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? Why should you destroy your ability to produce because of the economic failure of someone else? It doesn't say don't be generous. It says don't put your own ability to be productive at risk. Because other people sometimes make bad decisions. And they pick up their bag and put in their coins, and it has holes in it. Let not your coin fall through their holes. Lastly, because, I mean, how much advice can you give for the end time? There's certain things that we need to be doing. You could build a series of sermons. And, you know, Mr. Armstrong gave reference to simplifying your life. He gave reference to what our focus should be. Well, obviously, our focus needs to be to keep God first in our finances, to put him first and to keep him there. It is so easy to stop and say, well, I have little, when God says, indeed, you have little because you have done little. Let me bless you. Let me bless you, and I will increase you in those ways. Deuteronomy 8 is a description of God bringing Israel into the land and handing them so much opportunity and profitability that it'd be almost incredible for us to imagine. Imagine walking into a house that's been built, an orchard that's been planted, fields that have been laid out and the rocks removed, ready for production, and the labor has been done. And God says, here you go. I give it to you this day. Deuteronomy 8, verse number 11. Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you have eaten and are full and have built beautiful houses and dwelt in them, as you have the benefit of this society, as you have the increase that is so readily available to us, if we fail here, then this society generally will allow us to start over right next door or right on down the way. Opportunity is there for those who are indeed willing to do so. But it says, lest when you've eaten or full, have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, when your herds and flocks multiply, your silver and gold are multiplied, all that you have is multiplied, that your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which there are fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of the rock of flint, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you, to do you good in the end. And then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. You shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. Are you not even increased, enriched with goods, being thankful for God having given you the power, are you in need? God says, I am the one who gives you the power to have wealth. He who gives you power to get wealth. God says, that's me. Put me first. Don't forget me. Don't leave me out. You can keep the most of it, but I want my part, not because I need it, because all the earth is mine, but because you need to remember who I am so that I can bless you. When you humble yourself before me, I can bless you and give you increase. Malachi 3, famous passage on giving God his. Malachi 3, verse number 8. Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. And you say, in what way have we robbed you? Tithes and offerings. You're cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. The work can be done, not because God can't do it without money, but because God works through human agency. That there may be food in my house, and prove me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven. Pour out for you such blessings that there will not be room enough to receive it. I knew a man years ago in the church who had a job, a very profitable job, and good increase in income. And he really, it bothered him to take that portion of his tithe and give it to the church because it was a large amount of money. And he thought of what it was that he could do with that, and he reached the point to where he stopped tithing. He lost his job, lost his home and family, resources dried up, and later on he came back. And I was sitting talking to him, and basically financially he was down to the thinnest of margins. And he said, boy, would I just love to have right now what was left over before. What an incredible increase that would be. Imagine talking to somebody that tells you that straight to your face, because now he is very destitute in his means. He just lost it all. It would appear God simply took it away. God says, don't rob me. I give you the power to make wealth. I am the one who blesses you. Don't cut me out. This is for you. You know, I collected up a whole bunch of articles, and frankly, I didn't have time to boil them all down. And I just wanted to show that as we look at things happening around us, it's not a coincidence that the church was attacked in 95, and at the same time, the United States set off on a financial course that is going to absolutely court disaster. And yet we are God's people, and we need to be productive and producing, but we need to be wise. We can't be unwise and then say, God, bless me anyway. Bless me in spite of me. Sometimes God does indeed do that. He has done it to me at times. In spite of me, he has shown much mercy. But we can't expect that. We have to choose to do that which is right. We need to work and to labor with our hands. And by that I mean to be productive, our minds. We cannot indebt ourselves and consume our way into desperation and then ask God somehow to make it all go away. And we need to start out on that footing when we're young and when we're establishing ourselves. We must be careful. All those college loans, I'm looking at them coming down the pike. We are grateful with our children that we live in the state of Washington who has the Running Start program, and 2 years of that college is just books, no tuition. And our children, therefore, are still also at home because they would have been in high school otherwise. That is a huge blessing and benefit from the state, paid for by each of you a little bit. Thank you for contributing to our children in that way. But then you go on and college expenses go beyond the salary that I exist at, quite clearly. And now choices have to be made. So a person has to do what they can to labor, do what they can to be productive and protect the fact that the education must produce the increase that will pay for the means to get there. I knew a doctor in the church who went to school and he took out these loans, but because he was going out the other side when he became a doctor, he could turn then back and pay it all away. So there has to be a decision made in such a way. We cannot simply indebt ourselves for our pleasures. But when you go and do those hard decisions such as that, you do not do that for consumption. You must do that for school. You must live the tightest possible circumstance on your personal means in terms of your housing, in terms of your personal desires. You must reduce the options to travel and to have these many experiences. You must accomplish the task first and minimize your exposure to this system, because the system is mercenary and it will take advantage if it can. Wise as serpents, harmless as doves. We should work before God. We should protect, indeed, against losses. And we should diligently and carefully always put God first.